that okay, Mr. Barrett?
Okay.
Now, why don't we start then?
Mr. Chair.
We're going to call to order this meeting as a subcommittee of the full committee, and once we have achieved a quorum, we will go to Senator Vanderveer's bill. So at this point, I would like to call up Mr. Barrett, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Gambling Control Bill. We, as part of the smoking ban bill, Freedom to Breathe bill of last year, there was a requirement for a report on the fiscal impact on lawful gambling. And we do now have a quorum, but Senator Vanderveer, I'm going to go ahead and have him make that report, and then we'll come back to you. Mr. Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Tom Barrett, Director of the Gambling Control Board, and I just want to say I appreciate the opportunity to come before the board. Before I get into the reports, I just want to give a real brief background on who the Gambling Control Board is, what it is we do. Obviously, we regulate charitable gambling. We don't have any oversight of the tribal or the racing or the lottery. But with that said, we are monitoring over 1,400 licensed charitable organizations, that over 3,000 charitable gambling sites in Minnesota. And last fiscal year, gross receipts in charitable gambling were $1.2 billion in total sales. That makes Minnesota number one in the country. So the industry we're regulating is relatively large and covers a wide range of activity.
Mr. Bear, how do we compare with other states? How far ahead in being number one?
Nearly twice. The next closest state is the state of Washington at roughly $800 million.
Oh, okay, thank you.
Yep. As you pointed out, included in the 2007 Freedom to Breathe Act was a provision for the Gambling Control Board in cooperation with the Department of Revenue to conduct a study, a fiscal impact study on the impacts of the charitable gambling activity related to smoking ban. I do want to emphasize the board all along has been neutral on the policy of the smoking ban, but the activity is nonetheless something that we monitor for obvious reasons, be it the cash business and how they use the funds. But I do want to acknowledge the effort assistance we got from the Department of Revenue, specifically the Tax Research Group, when they got into some of the regression analysis that went well past my U of M statistics class, and it actually helped prove and disprove some of the things we were looking at. So I do want to acknowledge their assistance. But the statewide ban was effective on October 1. There were some other local bans, such as Minneapolis and St. Paul, that were in effect prior to that time. But I do want to emphasize that we only had roughly 3 months of activity that we were looking at. But with only those 3 months, we still show some obvious patterns in the activity once the ban went into effect. Allow me to give you some brief highlights from the study. The study was focused on the impact from the statewide smoking ban, but we also looked at other factors. We heard other contributing factors like the rising gas prices, the economy, unemployment, proximity to areas that didn't have a ban, and some of the historical patterns. So we actually factored that in as well. Some of the major findings we came up with, and it's included in the report, for the past 5 years, gross receipts from charitable gambling has declined. But for the last 5 years, it's been declining at the rate of roughly 2.5%, which by comparison to what we saw the fourth quarter last year, very small. But we wanted to point out, because some of the folks are saying, oh, charitable gambling's been going down for years. True statement, but not as much as what we just saw. For the fourth quarter of 2007, which covers the first 3 months of the smoking ban, gross receipts were down roughly 12.8% for the three-month period. Now, for that total drop, that equates to roughly a $40 million drop in receipts for charitable gambling. It's not all attributed to the smoking, but it's a drop for that one quarter. Now, what is significant is under chart number one, it shows a graphic delineation. It's on the cover of the report, but also on the inside. And you can clearly see that once the ban became effective, the gross sales line started to drop away from the historic pattern that we've shown for the last 5 years. Chart number two on page two also shows a progressive decline. where it started at roughly 9.7% in October, 11.7% in November, and 16.8% in December. Still too early to give a final factor number for January, but we're anticipating working with revenue that's roughly in the 16% drop as well, but that's not finalized. For areas without a ban, gross receipts dropped for that same period of time by nearly 14% for the quarter. This compared to areas such as St. Paul and Minneapolis that already had a ban that were dropping at roughly 6.3%. But based on the historical data and keeping in mind we only had the 3 months, the smoking ban, we think, caused statewide receipts to drop roughly 7.5 to 8.8%, which was what we were looking at. We were projecting back when the discussion was. How does that equate if we were to annualize that rate? That would be roughly $100 million decrease in gross receipts for charitable gambling.
And Mr. Barrett, you're just showing the correlations between those drops. You're taking into effect or into account the fact that the economy is tanking as well or not?
Madam Chair,
it's figured in.
Right. I mean, we actually try to work with a word that how would you define the economy? Because maybe for the farmers, good economy or tanking. But we did factor in the economy, and I'll touch base on that briefly.
Okay.
The 7.5% and 8% we think is directly related to the smoking.
Okay.
In other words, the receipts were dropping higher than that, but there were other factors such as unemployment, gas prices.
Okay.
So we did take that into account. I think the biggest concern right now or at this point is the board's concern on the impact of any decrease as relates to the net receipts. Gross receipts obviously are dropping, but to the extent that the charities can cover that difference or that drop or adjust their operations to maintain the expense calculations, that's something the board's concerned with in terms of their regulatory oversight. Because obviously we don't think the expenses are going to be able to keep up at the same rate as the decreased revenue. State and local gambling taxes also will drop. That's an obvious, but I do want to point out that the shift, when it's going away from the gambling tax, the belief is that the use of that discretionary dollar would find its way into some other form, be it a sales tax or something. So impact on the state could be minimal, but it's a bigger picture that we're looking at. But as relates to the gambling tax, and as I mentioned, other factors we also were considered, be it the business cycle, the unemployment, the rising gas, and then the areas without a ban. Dropping down to the recommendations, it's something that I think goes without saying that we're going to continue to monitor the activity. 3 months of actual history begs for more analysis. Will it continue at this rate? We suspect there's going to be a continued drop, but how much, we're not sure. Is it seasonal? That was something that we also took into account. Looking out the window, the snow, people tend to stay indoors, cold. We also are recommending the licensed organizations, in light of this activity, that they take a look at their own operation and adjust accordingly if they can. The Gambling Control Board should also look at the entire operation as relates to cost-saving opportunities, ways that the charities maybe could save more money. We also recommend the legislature consider issues dealing with the expense limitations. Now, those two previous points are already included in our legislative package that's pending on the floor.
I was going to say, isn't that in Senator Lori's bill?
Yes.
You have taken that into your bill, correct? Those provisions.
That is correct, Madam Chair. Both the 1 year 5% increase in the expense allocations available to be used, and the recommendation that the board take a look at ways to help better eliminate some of the overburdensome and sometimes duplicative regulations that charities are subject to currently.
And have we passed that bill off the Senate floor yet?
No, that is on general orders.
It's on general orders. What about the action in the House? Do you know?
General orders.
It's on general orders. Okay.
So that's a good point. I mean, two of the main provisions in the study are covered under the pending legislation. Hopefully, it'll be
and included
approved.
In those bills.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then finally, we'd be somewhat remiss if we didn't throw out the suggestion that the legislature consider maybe other forms if the concern if the concern was there on drop. I'll leave it at that. Some of the interesting highlights from the study. We did look at sites that already have a local ban, and you'll see in the report specifically related to the city of St. Paul. We looked at sites without a ban and the impact on that, and then we looked at sites that didn't have a ban but maybe were in proximity to sites that are still without a ban, be it the bordering sites around the state or within proximity to the tribal casinos. And what we found was roughly 20% of the sites within 5 miles of other locations that didn't have a ban, this is what we call the bridge connection. Those local communities like up in Fargo, Moorhead area, now Hastings, Dakota County, we focused on sites where the folks could go across the bridge to the other state where there's no smoking ban. And we found there's a 20% decrease in those sites, and we found that interesting to think there's some correlation. To the extent those other communities, states will catch up to Minnesota, remains to be seen. By contrast, we also looked at sites within proximity to the local tribal casinos. And what we found interesting, historically, sites in those areas didn't fare as well in terms of gross sales. In other words, their sales were down before, they're down again. We didn't find a strong correlation to say the smoking ban caused them more often to go to tribal, and I think that's important to note as well.
Some casinos not all casinos have identical policies with regard to smoking and alcohol policy. Is that's correct, right? They have different policies?
Madam Chair, I don't know, to be honest. And it maybe gives me an opportunity. When we went with this ban, and we have counterparts at the tribal casino. They have their own regulators and do a very good job. When we first got wind of doing the study, I thought, well, call them and just see. I know the information and everything is sensitive there, but I said, let me just call and see if they could tell us if they've seen an increase in bingo activity. Just mm-hmm. attendance, not the numbers or anything. And 2 days later, I got a 2-page letter from their attorney saying that, reaffirming that we don't have authority over the tribal. And it wasn't after any control.
Sure.
It was just
no,
if they wanted to share. So I'm not honest. I'm not sure what their policies are in the smoking.
Okay.
We did see correlating decreases as relates to the rising gas prices. The point is here, if you follow in the charts, I believe it's chart number 6 on page 9, you'll see that when gas prices rise, gross receipts, charitable gambling decrease, but not to the extent that it would cover the entire factor of the decrease. But we're alluding to in the study that there is a correlation to rising gas prices and decreasing charitable gambling. Similarly, we did a comparison using the lottery. An activity. There's some belief that Powerball rises, some of the charitable gambling folks play more in the lottery, and we couldn't find a strong correlation in that respect. So we point that out. Is it temporary? That was another point we had heard. Business will come back. And so we looked to the city of St. Paul as a guide because they were one of the first local units to initiate a ban. And on page 15, there's a chart specifically related to St. Paul. And as you can see, we don't see the rebound in terms of gross sales at that particular municipality. Gross sales are still down, but we do point out that there has been some success stories, even within the city of St. Paul and other states or other cities, to the extent that the charities work with bar owners. Legislatively, relatively new is the allowance for bar bingo. And so some of those activities have helped some of the charities. Some of the charities going back to the grassroots of raffles. But there are winners and losers. I don't want to leave anybody believing that it's going to come back. The decreases are significant. And it's something the board will obviously continue to monitor. We included provision in the report that we would quarterly get back to the legislators in terms of what's been happening. I'm not sure if that's too frequent or not frequent enough, but we plan to give some updates. We anticipate the decrease will continue. And then finally, somewhat concerned that the charities are going to struggle during this time of adjusting their operations to see what can be done in terms of meeting the expense calcs, as well as getting money to the bottom line for their charitable opportunities. With that, hopefully it was a brief enough summary of the smoking, the impact on the smoking ban.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. It seems to be a very thoughtful report. Are there questions or comments from members about the report? Senator Vickerman.
Madam Chair, my district is right down by borders two states, and I know for a fact that they're way down because they can go right across the border of Dakota, step across from Jackson, south just a few miles. I know Jackson's VFW is at least down 20%, and that's why I didn't vote for it. I don't like smoking, but it's hard when you border two states. It just is. But I kind of dispute maybe some of your when times get tough and there's no money, then people go to gambling. I know that for a fact. They're not going to win, but they think that's the way to do it. So I'm not so sure that the high-priced gas had that much to do with it. It had some to do with it. But, you know, people are always thinking they can make a fast buck. If they do, they can't, but they always try it. So I was caught in a difficult position. All my children said, Dad, you better vote for that smoking ban. And all my Legion clubs on the other side of that said, well, you better watch out because we need that income. So we weren't able to do any negotiations, and we learned to live with that in this place. And so I'm glad you're bringing this report because I want some people to understand that the smoking ban did pull down some charitable gambling money.
Mr. Barrett, in the recommendations, see, which page was that on?
Starts on 1, 2, and 3. Oh, I'm sorry, page 3 of the recommendations.
Page 3. When you talk in the first one, which is continuing to monitor the fiscal impact, how do you propose going about doing that? I mean, I don't know how much it cost to do that or whether there was a was there an appropriation?
Madam Chair, no. This is where I do give a lot of credit to our counterparts in revenue. Charitable organizations file monthly tax reports with revenue. That's all routine. But it's getting the reports out and then turning those over to the research department really helped. I mean, we had some insight from prior to the report coming out of the study. But without their help, again, pointing out some of the regression analysis, their statistical formulas to prove or disprove some correlations.
Are you going to be able to continue to do that?
Well, we're planning.
And would you be able to do it at this level of detail?
Madam Chair, we will what you want us to do. But I think what we plan to do is continue to monitor the gross receipts and net receipts. Again, net receipts are going to be something of particular interest to the board, regardless of, but it's something we do. And working with these charities that if they don't meet their expense calc, then our responsibility is to step up with some of the enforcement. And so we see that as a concern. So our report will pretty much show, here's what your gross receipts were, here what they are. Not much need for statistical other than working with the charities to go, what are you going to do to react? Or how can you? So you probably see less scientific, but still information that shows what the trend is.
Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Barrett, I know that your operational budget is linked to the receipts because it's a fee-based system. And as these receipts decline, I believe you would have less money to then work with on the enforcement side of things. Is that the case? And what is this downturn doing to enforcement actions?
Mr. Barrett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Gerlach, yes, a portion of our regulatory fees are based on gross receipts. Now it's 0.1%. It's a small percentage, but when we're looking at decrease of $100 million in gross and that factor, and we still charge a fee for a permit licensed organization, but we're concerned to the extent that we proposed this dedicated funding back when times were tough and state agencies were losing the regulatory authority. So we are concerned. But based on the what we have in our dedicated account right now, we should be covered current funding, current staffing, probably for the next 2 years. Then it's going to be a concern in terms of do we maintain the same level, assuming the license orgs stay the same, charitable gaming sites stay the same. It just decreased revenue. We'd regulate it regardless of how much they made.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, the reason I bring that up is it's something that we really should, as legislature, pay attention to, because of the credibility of the charitable gambling industry depends on Mr.
Good
Barrett's organization to make sure that it is everything is being handled upright, and if the enforcement is too hampered, then of course then problems crop up, and then you see that in the newspaper more than you do now. I mean, you see it regularly, and then it just hurts the entire industry. So it's important to keep track of the enforcement efforts that they're doing.
Any other questions or comments for Mr. Barrett? Okay. Mr. Barrett, how long would it take you to do the very quickly?
Yep.
Okay, and then you could be excused. So why don't we go right on to the annual financial summary report. Members have that.
This is the long legal size form.
Why don't you just tell us what the information is there for members to check out their
clubs,
et cetera.
3 years ago, back when organizations were having trouble, and it's become one of the most valuable tools for us as regulators, as well as the charitable organizations that are conducting gambling. It's simply a summary page that's produced by each licensed organization. It's a one-page summary. It tells them exactly how much their gross receipts were, what their prizes paid out, total expenses. And you can see on the report how it goes right along, even the taxes paid or charitable contributions. We use this report to identify charities that might be in trouble, get the expense calculation.
And which column should we look at if we want to get a hint that a charity might be in trouble or that a club might be in trouble?
Yeah. The key column we're looking at is the expense. It's about midway through the report. It's the allowable expense, and it shows a percentage. Mm-hmm. And that percent pertains to the allowable expense that the organization paid for salaries, product, rent. And right now, under current law, it's running at the 60-65% or 70%, excuse me, for the bingo. So another column that you can look at.
So when somebody has 90%.
They're in trouble.
They're in trouble.
But again, this is all public information. Before it comes to us, we ask the charities to share the information with their own membership. And then undoubtedly, once it becomes public, then we'll get calls back saying, geez, we never saw the report. And we'll normally follow up with the gambling manager to go. But it's all required to be. But as you see, it's summarized in one page. And mm-hmm. for the benefit of the legislators, it's every organization that had activity. There's additional detail posted on our website that the report can be sorted by the city. So if you're interested in those organizations in your areas, it's sorted by gross receipts. And then as you have in this one, it's sorted alphabetically by the organization. But again, I want to emphasize, it's a great report. Somebody might say, what's another form to fill out? But we use it for our benefit. The org uses it for theirs as well. And finally, I'll just leave it, but it's our annual report as well. It summarizes all the activity.
Are there any questions about the financial summary that members may have? And Mr. Barrett has always made himself available to talk to members about organizations within their own communities. If you see some that look like they're in trouble, you can certainly get more detailed information from him and what steps they're taking to get back on the statutory track. Okay, thank you very much.
Just one more.
Mr. Barrett,
I do want to point out that with us today is Peggy Moon, our board chair.
Yes.
Came down.
Welcome to the committee.
Too, so.
Did you? Okay.
Thank you
very much, Mr. Barrett, and the Department of Revenue for helping you put together that study. see Mr. Wilson out there. Senator Vanderveer. Senator Vanderveer brings us Senate File 2872. Is this the first committee for this bill, Senator Vanderveer?
Yes, it is, Madam Chair.
Senator Vanderveer has a delete everything amendment. Senator Gerlach?
Move that.
Moves the delete everything amendment, the A1 amendment, to Senate File 20. Whoops. The A2 amendment, the delete everything amendment. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. I'm assuming then that the Mr. McGowan, the summary is drawn to the A2 amendment?
Madam Chair, it was drawn to the A1. The A2 came up just recently.
Just recently. Okay. So we'll need you to now explain the A2 amendment and what the purpose of the bill is. And the Committee on Environment, this is a late bill, obviously, but the Committee on Environment, if we act on it favorably, has asked to see it.
Thank you,
Senator Vanderveer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 2872 with the amendment does is attempts to deal with a problem that most people, when they first hear about it, don't believe it. The fact that you can purchase a piece of property and simply based upon your name or the fact that you might own a parcel next to it, you all of a sudden can not only not use the parcel you just bought for the legal nonconforming use that it was previously eligible for, but you may have also made your own property, the first piece of property, nonconforming and unusable. So, and we have some examples of that here today. But again, most people don't believe that something like this exists, but it does when a local unit of government adopts a shoreland ordinance. And if you purchase a parcel that's involved in that, you find yourself unknowingly many, many times deprived of any use of that parcel. So just to give you a simple and what the A2 amendment merely addresses the fact that when the bill was originally drafted, it appears that, and this has been around a couple times, it passed the eminent domain in the House and was taken out in conference committee, but we assumed that the lot still existed. But the way the statute is now, when you close on a lot, a contiguous lot, and you actually purchase it, a nonconforming lot, that it disappears instantly. So the way the bill dealt with the issue wouldn't have worked. And so the new amendment was drafted, and it does the same thing. It basically says that we will treat everybody the same, every property owner the same. And that's all it does. It doesn't let you do anything you couldn't have done otherwise, as far as zoning or safety or building codes or anything like that. So to help clarify the problem, I would ask if, unless there are questions on to the amendment, that Alan Bakke could come up, and he's got a story that's simple and straightforward and might help you understand the issue better. If that's all right, Madam Chair.
Sure.
Madam Chair, Senators, I'm Alan Bakke from 1450 Bay Drive, Forest Lake, Minnesota. In the spring of 2006, I planned to purchase the house next door to my home on Forest Lake. I talked to the City of Forest Lake City Planner about what to do, what building codes I might have to deal with, and so on, because I planned to tear that house down, build a new one for myself, sell my existing home, and move next door. The lot next door is slightly larger, a little better view. I thought, boy, this will be great. So fortunately, I talked to Mr. Borland, the city planner of the city of Forest Lake, to find out what alligators I might encounter, and I found out I had a terrifically large one sometimes it's hard to remember to drain the swamp. Your mission is to drain a swamp when you're after rent and alligators, and I was suddenly. Fortunately, I didn't buy it. My lot is about 12,300 square feet. Property next door was 14.6. Both of them smaller than the required 15,000 to be a conforming lot. Had I bought that house, instantly it would have been combined with mine, and I'd have two houses on one lot, which I didn't particularly want to have. He explained that anybody else could come in and do it, could buy that house, tear it down, build a new one, and that's exactly what happened. Fellow came in from out of state, bought the lot, tore the house down, built a new one, very nice home. Nice guy, by the way. I'm glad to have him for a neighbor. Only it wasn't me. I felt that I should have been able to do the same thing he could, and I couldn't because I owned the house next door. I wasn't in a position to sell my house and live somewhere else for a period of time and then come back in and buy it or do anything like that.
You were not in a position.
I wasn't in a position to do that. I needed to live in my existing house, so I built a new one and try to, you know, just do one at a time. So I ended up, I just gave it up and didn't do it at all. But it seems patently unfair to me that anybody else could do it. I'd planned to conform with all the setbacks, all the side lot setbacks and everything else, but I couldn't do it.
So let me just understand this. So your plan would have been to have bought that lot, and there was already a house on it.
Already a house on it.
Take that house down, build a house on that lot, and then tear your house down that you were living in.
No, my plan was to sell the house I was living in now to somebody else and simply move next door. It would still be two lots, just like it is now. That was my plan anyway.
And the law forbids you to do that. Why?
Well, because both lots are non-conforming. They're both under 15,000 square feet by a little bit, and as such would have to be instantly combined into one property and not redividable again.
Madam Chair?
I see.
Madam Chair?
Senator Pappas.
So this is a city zoning law that says that your lots have a minimum of 15,000 square feet.
That's correct.
And so how would your legislation fix this, Senator Vandiver?
Well, Madam Chair, we need to be clear on one thing. A non-conforming lot is still buildable. They're legal non-conforming lots of record. They're just lots that, because a municipality or county or whatever has gone through their zoning, and they have come up with different minimum lot sizes, the existing lots of record are still illegal use and can still be, you know, used as zoned. So what this does is it simply says that based upon the ownership, or one, you cannot combine the lots without an owner's permission. You can't, you know, just the fact that you purchase an adjacent, or the house next door to you doesn't mean that because you own both of them that they are now one parcel. So the bill says you can't do that. And then the second thing it does is it said that you cannot treat whoever owns these lots any differently just because of their name or just because they own both of them. You have to treat all the property owners the same. And that's all. It doesn't change any health and safety, building code, setback, nothing. Doesn't change anything like that. It just simply says that we will treat everybody the same.
And Senator Vandiver, in your mind, what is the reason for the current law? And I'm sure we'll hear from others who think the current law is a good deal. But why do you think we have this law?
Madam Chair, members, from discussions with other agencies and counties and interest groups, it appears that this is a way to decrease the number of non-conforming uses or non-conforming parcels statewide. And I think it, to some people, it is an advantage because it does, could potentially reduce density on Lakeshore and in sensitive areas like that. However, I think that even though the outcome might be desirable, that there, I don't know, as Tom Bach's dad says, there's no right reason to do the wrong thing. I think the implementation of it, as you'll hear, we have a little different story if you'd allow. It gets even messier for people, and it's not even, you know, Mr. Bakke's story is one, very simple one, but it does get more and more complicated. But I think it's a you know, some perceive it as a benefit that way, but I think if that's your goal, it's certainly a worthwhile one. I don't think this is an appropriate way to achieve it. So,
are there questions for Mr. Sure. Bakke or comments? Senator Fickerman, and then
I'm just always cautious when we do this, because if this gets to be a statewide law, mm-hmm. a lot of things could change, and I hope somebody from the city or the counties, at least I'm not against it, but I want to be sure where
we're
going to
be hearing from the DNR. I hope. Senator Lori?
My question may be more appropriate for the DNR, I guess. I was just wondering the extent of this problem statewide. Senator Vanderveer, if you have any idea how many lots fall under this statewide. I actually do have one up out of Pine City, I think on Pokegama Lake, a person who brought a very similar issue before me. And so I'm kind of glad to see this moving. And you did a very good job explaining a very complicated situation. It took a while to wrap your head around what's happening here.
I'm sure.
Do you have an idea of the statewide extent of this problem, though?
Senator Vanderveer?
Madam Chair, Senator Lowry, Lori, we've had some discussions about it. I know that we had tried, in fact, one of these amendments had tried to narrow it down so it wouldn't have an effect that the Department of Natural Resources had thought it might, an earlier amendment. But I don't think we know, I don't think it's a huge situation. If there may be some things we'd want to include in the bill to limit it in some cases, as you'll hear from the agency. But I don't think it's a huge problem, because it isn't like you're telling people they can, you know, you're making the lots conforming or you're changing building codes and setbacks and things like that. So I think it's but I don't have a specific.
Senator Lori, and then Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, thank you. One of the things that I know was discussed as I was working on this issue just a little bit was the problem is somewhat magnified when there's already two existing buildings on the structure. I mean, it's the inequities seem even more unfair when there's already an existing building and you'd like to, you know, even if you'd like to reconstruct or even not. I mean, in my constituents' case, there's two existing buildings. They own both lots and both buildings and can't sell one. You know, so they're stuck actually having to maintain ownership of two residents that causes them significant heartburn. But maybe something to do with building. I mean, I think that the desire was to take, you know, some folks had lots that were significantly out of conformity with rules that were being adopted, and if they were not built upon as of yet, I mean, the burden placed upon them to put together lots that weren't even built yet is maybe not as great as the burden, you know, in cases like this where there's already buildings existing, homes, yeah. If you will. I don't know if you'd thought about that at all or have any.
Madam Chair.
Senator Vanderveer.
Senator Lowry, I have a witness here that can kind of show us the horrors of that. If it's all right, we could have Mrs. Ness come up and just tell her story real quickly.
Fine. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Ness, if you would state your name for the record.
Nancy Ness at 5620 Edgewater Boulevard in Minneapolis. We own some lakeshore up in Crow Wing County that It's been in my family. It's a legal non-conforming lot. It's been in my family since 1950. And my husband and I had the opportunity to purchase the property next door to that, which is a very large conforming piece of property, one of the larger lots on Bay Lake, which was 200 feet that we purchased. And we went. Our intent was to eventually give our original lake home to our both our kids, and then we were going to build a retirement home on the conforming lot. Well, we went to go and get the permit, and they said, we can't give it to you because you have a non-conforming lot. So what they did was they put them two together, and they made one large conforming lot non-conforming now, which was such a surprise to us. On this conforming lot that we purchased, there's a lake home that's only 33 feet from the shoreline. And our intent was to take that down, move it back at the 100-foot setback, meeting all the requirements that the county would like. And we can't do that. So we're forced to rebuild around the footprint of that property, 33 feet from the lake. And it just makes no sense. And then our neighbors right next to us who have a small, legal, non-conforming lot, the same size as our original property, because they don't own a contiguous lot, they were able to go in, get an over-the-counter permit, and build a 3,200-square-foot structure on their 75-foot lot. And here we have 275 feet, and we can't do anything. That's what's frustrating about it. And also, the county recognizes two separate addresses. We have two separate tax statements, but yet we can't sell it. We can't sell one or the other now. And the property loss, I mean, we've lost quite a bit in property value by having them join the two together. So that's what's so frustrating about this. And here you really want to do something that's good. You want to take a lake home down that's only 33 feet from the lake and move it back, meeting all of the guidelines that the county wants. And right now we're forced to rebuild around the footprint. So,
Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, I have a question from Ms. Ness about the previous story we heard. The non-conforming was they were too small. Yours, you're combining a small non-conforming one with a large conforming one.
Right.
You said it becomes non-conforming. So
right.
Yours is not a size non-conforming issue?
Ours,
Ms. Ness.
Our original property that we have a lake home on is 75 feet. We purchased, on Bay Lake, you have to have 150 feet. We purchased a lot that was 200 feet, thinking there wouldn't be a problem because it's more than conforming. But now the city joined them together, and we have 275, and we need 300.
In order to build another...
Right.
So it's
so we're forced to rebuild around the footprint, which I don't think, you know, that is, you know, we're into preservation of lakes. We belong to the Minnesota Lakes Association and everything. It just doesn't make any sense.
So if you want to rebuild, you have to build 33 feet from the lake?
We have to build around the footprint of the property. And we have this huge lot.
Mm-hmm.
So it just doesn't make any sense, you know.
Senator Rory.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe I can try to make a little bit more sense of this, because I think that what the issue is you have to build within the same footprint of the house because you don't need a permit to do so. Is that correct?
We still have to get a permit.
But, I mean, you don't have to. You can get that permit to work on an existing structure, whereas
right.
if you go in to get a new a permit for a new construction, then all of the new rules would apply. Hmm. And what you have is one conforming lot rather than one existing lot and a conforming lot. They put the two together
right.
is your issue. So it's not that you have one non-conforming lot. It's that you have one lot, period. The lot is conforming. But it's only one. They wouldn't
allow
you.
It's actually non-conforming now.
It's non-conforming now with the 275
right.
feet.
So we had one large conforming property.
How did it become non-conforming?
Because they joined them together. And on Bay Lake, you know, if we wanted to build another structure, we would need 300 feet.
Ma'am Chair, for clarification, in other words, it's conforming for one house. It's not conforming for
two
lots or two houses.
Correct.
Right.
But is there two houses on it now?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. One is in much need of repair, and that's what we want to take down, the original, or the property that we bought, the place that's only 33 feet from the lake.
So the conforming parcel caught the non-conforming disease. By
pitching.
Because they touched.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
So if you took down both structures, could you build one house 100 feet back?
Yes.
But you want the other structure for
your
children.
Well, the other structure is way too good to take down, you know, and it's...
How far back is that?
That is 60 feet, I believe, from the lake.
But
so, it's been in my family since 1950, you know, and there's a lot of sentimental value to that. But, you know, what I don't understand is the county says they want to get rid of the non-conforming lots, but yet our neighbors next door are building on a non-conforming lot. I mean, they're not, you know, they're building brand new dwelling there. That isn't getting rid of a non-conforming lot when they're granting building permits like that, too. So it just doesn't make any sense.
Senator Marty?
I have a question in a slightly different direction. I understand the unfairness of this, and I'd be curious to hear from DNR and others, but I had a question for Mr. McGowan, and that is, we're talking about residential properties on lakes, but I presume this language, does this deal with any kind of non-conforming parcel? Are we dealing with business properties and everything here, too?
Mr. McGowan?
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, the original A1 amendment just dealt with shoreland. That provision was removed, so it does apply statewide to, I'm not sure.
Was it A2?
It applies to commercial property as well.
Madam Chair, when dealing with this, I would encourage us to try and address the problem, but be cautious. As somebody said, how many properties was this applied to? We might want to at least limit it to whether it's lakefront or not, at least to residential property, so we don't have unintended consequences. Again, I don't know what they'd be, but I think we might want to keep that in mind as we go ahead on this.
Senator Gimsey?
Yeah, I guess I have a question. Thank you, Madam Chair. Concerning who labels a lot conforming and non-conforming, what is that based off of county requirements and county zoning issues, or is it a state mandate type thing? Are we dealing with 87 different counties and zoning ordinances here, or are we just dealing with DNR regulation, state regulation?
Senator Vanderveer?
No, Madam Chair, Senator Gimsey, I don't believe we are, no, because we're not preempting any zoning setback, building code, anything like that. All we're saying, where this comes into play, I believe, is when you adopt the shoreland ordinance, the model shoreland ordinance, and the DNR can kind of maybe explain that, but when a municipality or a local unit of government, whether county or city, adopts this, then this rule comes into play. And that's really the only time. I mean, there's nothing else in real estate that I know of that says that based on who owns it, if you buy a parcel because your last name is the same as, or you have the parcel next to it, all of a sudden things change, you know, just based on the fact that the same owner has both parcels. I don't think that's applicable in any other circumstance that I know of. No, I could be wrong, but so we're not preempting. This isn't changing a zoning ordinance of a particular of the cities or counties across the state. This is a state. I believe this was a state law. Maybe this might be a good time to have DNR come up. If that's up to you, Madam Chair.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I have a lot of sympathy, and I think the unfairness is what strikes me. But looking at the A1 and A2 amendments, I do like the fact that the A1 is limited to shoreland and construction of single-family residences. Not that we shouldn't look at beyond that, but I think we'd be wise to limit what we're trying to do to make sure we're fixing the problem without causing other things that we're not aware of what we're doing. So I don't know the reason for moving from A1 to A2, and there may be plenty of other changes, but I just noticed the shoreland properties is what the A1 deals with in construction of residential property, single-family ones, and that all disappeared in the newer one. I don't know if there's a point purpose for that other than, well, let's be consistent. But well,
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, what it was is nothing mysterious or anything. The First Amendment said that or didn't deal with the simple fact that when you had bought the second parcel, then the two did not exist any longer. So we were dealing with them as if they did, is my understanding. And so since the two parcels don't exist anymore and you just had one, then saying that you can't not issue a permit just based on ownership as your only reason, to what? Now we had one lot, so it didn't fix anything. So that was the reason. So if, you know, we want to narrow it down, and certainly that's...
Senator Murray.
Madam Chair, I understand your second point and why you would need that so they can't combine it on you, but I guess I'd feel more comfortable if we kept the shoreland in the single-family residence and added that second provision you mentioned.
Which I think would be fine.
You might want to...
Madam Chair, I would like Mr. McGowan could begin looking at that, and then I guess I think I'd like to hear from what DNR.
We're going to hear from, thank you very much, Ms. Ness, Mr. Bakke.
Yes.
We're going to hear from Mr. Lacasmo, and some others have asked to testify too. We will let anybody who wants to speak. Mr. Lacasmo.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You've heard the concerns of the committee with regard to these citizens.
For the record, I'm Kent Lacasmo, Director of DNR Waters. And I do have two handouts that may help put this in context, Senator. The contiguous non-conforming parcels have been an issue for many years, and essentially what happened is many of these lots were platted before we had statewide shoreland standards, and those were adopted in the 1970s, and then local governments adopted ordinances. And they adopted ordinances then that created certain standards for given classes of lakes. And you can... I realize these handouts haven't got around, but there are standards on the backside general development lake, for example. The most developed, like a Mille Lacs Lake or a Lake Minnetonka, has a 100-foot lot width and a lot size of 20,000 square feet. Let me not use Minnetonka because that's incorporated and has sewer. So in an unsewered area, these are the dimensions. A recreational development has a larger lot width, 150 square feet, a larger lot size, and natural environment is the most restrictive, with a lot width of 200 and a lot size of 80,000 square feet. So if you have underlying zoning that has lot sizes that are different than that, then you end up with non-conforming lots. And if you look on the blue handout, it's kind of the map. This is just generic. On the left side of this diagram is general development. The top part of that is if you met the dimensional standards in the state shoreland rules, and those rules... then the local government has to adopt, those are minimum standards, they adopt that or something more restrictive. And what we see is something like on the bottom of that page, the lower left, you have these old plats with 40 or 50-foot wide lots, and some of them are built on, some aren't. Some may own an adjacent lot, which would make it compliant if it meets the size and dimensional standards, and there are some that can be combined. And then the same thing is shown on the right-hand side for recreational development lot where the dimensional standards are larger. And there are lots in the state that are very small, 4,000, 5,000 square feet, where it takes four or five lots to reach a compliant lot size. And those are the ones that we're most concerned about. You know, at the last hearing or the last date we were going to have a hearing, we talked to one of the other witnesses who has two residences on two lots. I think that's an issue that we should figure out a way to address. And we've talked to Crow Wing County where that one is, and we're working through those processes. The main issue and the reason for these lot dimensional standards are to assure that you have adequate size for a septic treatment system, adequate size for to make sure you have some impervious surface limits, so you don't put a large home on a small lot, basically, and that's the type of development that we're currently seeing. Our concerns specifically on this bill as amended were that we don't think this amendment solves the problem, because some of the examples that I've recently become aware of over the last couple of years talking about this, these lots are already combined into one parcel. So you would have to go through a subdivision process, and then you'd have to figure out how you could make those compliant lots if you're going to subdivide them. So if they're already been combined, I don't think this lot or this bill as amended fixes that problem. We have looked at resolving this problem. We talked about it with the North Central Lakes Pilot Project in North Central Minnesota, and they were looking at having some minimum dimensional standards and 75% of these lot widths, so governments could adopt something like that. And a few counties and municipalities have adopted some standards to deal with the nonconforming lots. And we will be looking at that as part of the rule process that we're currently going through. We need some standards, and on some of these lots, I think there was a Stearns County example where it would take four or five individual platted lots to even reach 75% of the minimum lot required under the ordinance. So there are lots that are too small. Those are the ones that we're most concerned about. It would seem like the examples that you heard today are something, Vanessa's example, there may be something that can be worked out there. I know that's been litigated. I'm not exactly sure where that is. I don't have the background to really respond to that. Local government units have been dealing with this issue for a number of years. They've been effectively dealing with it. There have been cases that have gone to, through the court system. The Court of Appeals has ruled in the past on this practice, and basically they recognize the longstanding philosophy of government here was to gradually eliminate nonconformities over time. And I'm sure we can always find horror stories where that doesn't quite fit well. The other concern that we have about this, and I know this is something that gives the realtors and others fits, that we think that there should be some disclosure. If you're selling something that clearly cannot, it's clearly a non-conforming lot, and it's a fraction of the necessary size, that there should be disclosure for the buyer. Otherwise, we're just passing the problem on from the sellers this year to a buyer next year, is who the people you'll hear about. We're addressing this as part of the shoreland rules, and it's going to be something that we'll talk with the county, cities, and townships in how we can come to solutions to resolve at least some of these issues. I don't believe that we can solve all of these issues, because there are some that are, just too small, and we have to look at those size limits.
Mr. Loxasmo, how long has the department been working on the shoreland rules?
Madam Chair, we had initial rules in 1970. They were upgraded, amended in 1989, and we just started last year. There was legislation that required us to commence rulemaking, and we've done that. The advisory committee met, last week. There were some other meetings today, so we're in that process of going through that the rule amendment now. And I expect they will be ready to go to the formal rule process at the end of this biennium, in June 30th. And we're 2 years out to having a final rule.
Long time. I guess it's not, long in terms of generally rulemaking, but it seems like it's a long time to me. Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, Mr. Loxasmo, I'm not sure. I'm just curious how much these are state lot standards. Are they mandatory? In other words, like the Nessus case where they now have 275 front feet, I guess it is, or lakeshore frontage, and the standard would be 150. And does a county, could Crow Wing County, give a variance in a case like that saying, well, it actually is better to move that 33-foot away house 100 feet away, and it's almost big enough to have two of them, and if they're going to redivide the lots between them and their kids or whoever, they'd have to divide it to 150 versus 125 front footage or whatever. Does the county have flexibility to do that, or are these standards absolutely rigid and they have no choice in that?
Madam Chairman, Senator Marty, the shoreline standards, the state rules are minimum statewide standards. The counties can be more restrictive, but the counties also are the local, or counties or cities, are the local governing unit, and they could evaluate variances, and that's their decision whether to issue or not a variance. Whether or not there's sufficient lot size, adequate place for septic systems, all of those other considerations, I'm not familiar with that specific case, but there are other things that the county could weigh. And counties do issue variances for these types of things. If they're too far afield, the department has sued counties in the past over their issuing variances we felt were totally inappropriate. That's a rare occurrence, but counties do, or cities, do have the option to review proposals and variances.
Senator Marty and then Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, Mr. Lacismo, I'm not sure if I'm confusing the two stories or not, but it does seem that a county trying to comply with the state standards and trying to protect the lakes would be smarter to, one, give a variance to something that's close to that, and two, and I don't know, maybe they can't have say over this, but not give permits to continue for allowing somebody to come in, tear down the house when they've got a small non-conforming lot, like one of the two stories involved a neighbor going in where they couldn't buy the lot. Because the inconsistency between what they have and what their neighbor, somebody else coming in and buying, seems to be not very helpful. If they can put in a big new house on a tiny lot and the county or city doesn't do anything about that, but then one that's very close, they toe the line so rigidly.
Well, Madam Chairman, Senator Marty, there are significant differences in local governments across the state on how they approach this. The standards that we looked at when we were doing the North Central Lakes project was for these nonconforming lots to have a standard of 75, meeting at least 75% of the dimensional requirements. So instead of having 100 feet wide, if you had 75 feet wide and if you met those dimensional lot area requirements, they could do that. There's a number of counties that have adopted that into their ordinance, and we've approved that flexibility. And we plan on looking at that and modifications of that in the current shoreline rule process.
Senator Vanderveer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Senator Marty, too, I think, with all due respect, the department is misrepresenting what the bill does, first of all. It does not change and let you use 50-foot lots. It doesn't, unless you can do that already today, except that you own two lots together, or that you go in and purchase one of those 50-foot lots and you already own another one. This does not let you do anything to those lots that you can't do today, except by the fact that you have the same, that you own, you're purchasing one right next to it. Anybody else could come in. This only impacts what happens if somebody else could come in, buy the lot themselves, and build on it. But you can't just because you own the parcel next door, and you would then own two different parcels. So to say that this is somehow changing standards that exist in any county or local unit of government is simply wrong. It does not do that. And all it does is say that the property owners will be treated the same and not differently because of their name. So it's easy to get confused here, but we are not changing at all any local ordinance or any local building code, setbacks, lot coverage ratio, any of those things. All we're saying is you will treat the property owners the same. What one could do, another could do. That's all we're saying. And to say it any different, I think, is perhaps not understanding what the bill does.
Madam Chair.
Okay, are there other Senator Bickerman, I wanted to go on to other testimony. Is there, do you have a question?
No, I want to be sure we hear from maybe the counties. And
yeah, I'm going to ask, is there anyone else who wishes to speak on Senate file 2872? If you come forward, please. You could identify yourself, please, for the record.
My name is Thomas V. Selseth. I live at 6004 Creek Ridge Court, Minnetonka, Minnesota.
Sure.
And I happen to be the parcel that Kent was talking about, where I own two non-conforming lots with two year-round homes on 100-foot lots that were both non-conforming that had homes there since 1974. Unbeknownst to me, I bought the one next door from a family and went in to get a permit to do it, and they said, well, geez, now you have contiguous lakeshore. I happen to also be a realtor of 38 years. I never heard of the law. The people were elderly and retired. Anyhow, the way that I got treated at the city was just appalling. And they talk about the name situation. If you go to Crow Wing County, they told me had I bought it my wife's name or my company name, I wouldn't have had a problem. Mm. And that's not the truth. So there's Crow Wing County. I've got a new neighbor next to me now that went in and said, oh, geez, you live next to Mr. Selseth. We put him through the ringer, which took me 2.5 years to get things resolved. But the point being is I own two non-conforming properties on a little over 100 foot each on Round Lake up in Crow Wing County right past Mille Lacs, and I can't sell the property because I have the same name, the same as Senator Vandeveer is talking about. Because I own the one next door, I can't sell it. But the county says, oh, geez, they gave me the variance to do what I wanted to do on the one. I met all their criteria of moving bunkhouses, getting things away from the lake and doing that. And they said, well, you know, your other house will consider it a guest house, even though I think the regulation says it can't be in excess of 700 square feet. Well, it happens to be a 1,300 square foot A-frame home. They're both year-round. And I'm sitting here held hostage. I can't do anything. And as Nancy Ness said, if I got to combine it and sell it as one parcel with two year-round homes, my value has actually gone down. I have two legal descriptions, two separate parcels, two separate mortgages. The county has done nothing. One is seasonal, one's non-homestead. Where am I sitting? You know, they didn't combine anything. And if they did combine it, now I'm in default on my mortgage, so the mortgage company is going to go due on sale with my one mortgage. What happens if I default on the one and let it go to the bank? You know?
What does happen? Do you lose both?
I own both properties.
No, would you lose both?
No, I'd only lose the one I default on. If I own.
Then what happens to it?
Well, I don't know. Tell me what happens to it. I don't know. With the county, I don't have a clue. But if I defaulted and the bank took it back, well, geez, who made it contiguous or who combined my two lots together? Nobody's ever done any such thing. So how can I have, I got two separate legals, two parcels that have been there since the 70s, you know, back before all this was implemented. But now I'm held hostage, and what do? Sell both parcels and go out and look for one on somewhere else? You know, it just doesn't make sense to me. It's crazy. I understand, and I don't disagree with disclosure in terms of telling people, but, you know, the gentleman next door passed away. His wife was 80-some years old. The family didn't know that, you know, I was going to create contiguous lakeshore, nor did I when I bought it, but I did, unbeknownst to me. So, but I am in a situation of two lots, a little over 100 square feet, or I mean 100, you know, foot of frontage on both, did everything the county wanted me to do, and they said, well, sorry, you can't sell it. All my septic systems, everything is in compliance everywhere. But if I want to sell, I need to sell both homes. And it just...
To one person.
You know, and yeah, the county did bend a little bit to tell me that, well, the one will be a guest house, even though the rules say that it can't be over 700 square feet. And it's, like I said, it's a 1,300 square foot plus A-frame year-round home. So it just seems a little crazy to me. And, you know, I have talked with Kent and the other people, and they're willing to, you know, talk to the county, but I think there needs to be some clarification. And that's why I'm here, and I've talked to Nancy Ness, and I've talked to the lobbyists from the Minnesota Association of Realtors. I'm glad that they are here, and they're active and involved in this. That's important to me as well. So thank you for listening to me. Any questions?
Thank you very much. Okay. Appreciate it. Anyone else wish to speak on this issue? Get in line, I guess. We're going to take, oh, maybe another 10 minutes or so, 10, 15 minutes at the most, and then we'll take some action on this bill, whatever the committee wishes to do, and because it's really bad outside, I'd like to have people have an opportunity to get home, Senator Vannevier, but you have had a very full hearing on this bill. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record, we'll take either one of you.
Go ahead. My name is Paul Reavers. I'm a Bloomington lawyer, and I represent governmental entities across the state, counties, cities, townships.
Okay. My name is. Did you want to make a statement?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I mean, I think, you know, the looking at the overall purpose, I've dealt with this mainly outstate. This, the seeing this in terms of the homes, this is unique, and certainly an issue that I know the DNR is looking at and counties are looking at as well. The typical situation that we find is, you know, situations in Douglas County or Otterdale County where you have these really small lots where it may take four or five lots to meet the minimum standards because of these plats that were long existing. So the purpose, the overall purpose, is truly those small lots, and that's where I've seen that. And that's the concern, I think, that just having worked in the area, mainly outstate, it's unique to see this in the metro area, this type of issue. Again, usually I see it up in the Otterdale, Douglas, Cass County area where I've been involved. And that's the concern, is this takes away everything. I mean, I think the lakeshore type issues are significant, and that's where I think the DNR, where this should be addressed in rulemaking, is to address these unique situations where it's very close and you have two homes on there versus trying to sell off the lots, because that's where we've seen the conflict is, hey, I've owned five lots, I want to start piecemealing them off. It's like, well, no, you can't do that. Maybe you can make two or one big one, and we think that fosters the, you know, the protection of the environment. So, I mean, there's the counties, my clients get kicked around a fair amount on not doing enough environmental review, not protecting natural resources. And so, therefore, you know, having those minimum lot sizes are important, and it is an important issue for protecting the lakes that we all value. So I'd ask the committee to be cautious, and I think we look to the DNR for guidance. Senator Marty, you asked a question, you know, on the variance. My clients have granted those variances in the past, too, where, you know, the situation fits. So the answer is yes, they can, and they do. And that's the typical situation you have, is when you have that unique situation, it's the variance process that typically you can address it, because you can't identify everything. You pass a law or you pass an ordinance, you're trying to do what's right, and you can't identify every situation like we've heard today, some very unique situations, so, which may well fit that variance criteria. But that's where I think that fits better. And you deal with those unique situations all the time where people are unfortunately come up with these situations. So with that, I would urge caution, and this isn't the language I've got a lot of concerns with. I'm going to defer right now, but I think there's a lot of problems with the language, and I think it needs to be worked through. It's not an issue that I say it doesn't need to be dealt with. I just think it needs to be dealt with the DNR arm in arm.
Okay. Identify yourself, please, for the record, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Johnson. I'm here representing the League of Minnesota Cities. Would agree with the comments you heard from the previous testifier. Just want to start with a couple of general reminders, kind of the background of this. One is that the reason local units of government are implementing these actions is to try and deal with the fact that we have lakeshore lots that were made much smaller than is sustainable for the lakeshores. Because of state rules and a priority to, frankly, protect water quality and lessen the density on some of these very densely developed lakes, these lot size standards were put in place. There are some unintended consequences of that, and I think you heard some good cases today where either local variances might be needed to address it, or the shoreline rules may need to have some flexibility put into them. It was just last session that the legislature required the DNR to start a new shoreline rule process. Interestingly enough, it was for the opposite reason. It was to make it much, much more difficult to build on shoreland. Today you're hearing kind of the other side of that. But the new rules were required to be started in January, and they were, and that process is going forward.
We do have considerable concerns with the exact language that you have in front of you. It does go far beyond dealing with shortland issues. We have many cases of cities that have non-conforming size lots that have nothing to do with shoreland. It's a community that has all of its old homes that were on septic systems. They have been since they were built in the 20s, 30s, 40s. The lots are not of a size suitable for that. The city does not have a wastewater system of its own. And in order to get some of these lots up to appropriate size, the only opportunity a local government may have is if contiguous ownership situations come up. And that is used to address everything from fire safety concerns about lot size to wellhead protection issues, all kinds of things. Really, the only way we can address substandard size lots is if contiguous ownership occurs. You can't magically create more land and take a small lot and make it bigger. So I would also add this is one of the probably unintended consequences of changes that were made 3 years ago to our nonconforming restrictions and what local governments are able to restrict for local development and ordinances, because we now have things that are being allowed on lots that previously were nonconforming and would not have allowed those types of construction, that because of the changes we made to loosen up those restrictions, we're now seeing cases where somebody can build something on a nonconforming lot they previously couldn't. This is a very complicated issue, and I'm hoping that we can address some of these, in particular, shoreland concerns, both through the DNR rules and through trying to focus in on the cases like you heard today where you have year-round residences in contiguous ownership in shoreland that are very close to conforming size. There's an obvious case to be made there that there should be a solution to that, not a continuing problem.
Right. Any questions or comments for Mr. Johnson? Or I'm sorry, don't.
Reavers.
Is there anybody else who wishes to speak either in support or in opposition to this bill? Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Madam Chair, members, I'm Keith Carlson from the Minnesota Intercounty Association.
Mr. Carlson.
I also appear here with concerns about this legislation. Mr. Johnson did cover most of the issues that I was going to raise. I'm just going to point out one other example of nonconformities not related with Lakeshore that would be affected by this bill. And they exist within a matter of a few blocks of this this Capitol. That's lots that have a residence in both the front portion of the lot and the back portion of the lot that are served by common sewer lines, a sewer line that extends from the street, goes to the first house, and then continues on to the back residence. That's a non-conforming use. If a clog occurs in that line in the first home, there's really no way to access that. And so to bring those lots into conformity, the zoning authorities here in the cities are requiring that a separate line be put in at such time that those parcels are split and the back lot or the front lot is sold. Madam Chair, the one other thing I do want to make the committee aware of is when this legislation was heard in the other house, counties, the DNR, did make a commitment to work on this issue over the interim. It's already occurring in the context of the rules, but to address the specific situation of one of the testifiers, the individual where it was just corners of two lots, we said we would work on that issue and try and see if some solution can become up locally. With that, I'll conclude and be happy to take any questions.
Anybody have any questions or comments for Mr. Carlson? Okay. Anybody else wish to speak? Ms. Diori?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Susan Diori, and I represent the Minnesota Association of Realtors. And in essence of time, I will be very brief and not repeat anything. I do want to speak just quickly. I think from our perspective, it's purely an issue of the property rights issue, meaning all of the testimony you've heard before us. And I think the other thing that's very complex, perplexing in this issue is that these lots are not being legally combined, as was previously testified to. And that creates a whole other concern about the ability for future sale. And finally, I'll just quickly note that There already is disclosure requirements as it pertains. I know that's been an issue that's been raised here. There are already real estate licensees are required to disclose all material facts of which they are aware when they go to sell any property type. And, Madam Chair, as you can attest to, so are sellers. with that, I'll end my testimony. Thank you.
Okay, what is the committee's pleasure with this? Senator Marty, did you come up with an amendment or at this point? Senator Pappas?
Madam Chair.
And I don't know whether members heard, but if we did act on the bill, the Committee on Environment wants to see the bill.
Madam Chair.
Senator Pappas.
Madam Chair, did I hear somebody say something about something being in litigation?
Senator Vandeveer?
Madam Chair, I believe Ms. Nancy Ness's was, but isn't.
It's no longer?
Is no longer.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure that we weren't doing anything
right
to impede.
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, I guess, you know, I feel really sympathetic to the witnesses, and I feel like these are really important problems. But I'm really worried about unintended consequences, that the legislation is just drafted to have too broad a sweep. If it had been drafted to be kind of very, very, very narrow shoreline, you know, lots that are, you know, 75% in compliance, you know, something like that, I'd be more inclined to support it. But I think without knowing, you know, what kind of impact this is going to have, and then also knowing that, you know, people got the message. I mean, and there is going to be attention paid to this issue, and we certainly could, as a committee, look at it again next year or follow it during the interim. But I don't feel ready to kind of move on this legislation the way it is before us today.
Anybody else wish to speak? Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess maybe it is broader and it could be honed down, but I think that these people have had a real injustice dealt to them. And if they had bought a lot two addresses down, it wouldn't be an issue. But because they bought the one next door and they're contiguous, it becomes an issue only for them. And it just seems patently unfair that they are going to have to combine those two lots when somebody else wouldn't have had to have done that. If the fellow who had bought the lot and wanted to tear down a house and live in his current house while he was building it, if he could have talked a builder into buying that lot for him and building the house, then and he never would have had the two properties at the same time, sold the other house right when it was time to move into the other one, he would have had no problem. But it's not easy to find somebody who will work with you like that. So, I mean, there's ways to get around it, but I don't think people should have to get around it when anybody else can do it except the person who has the contiguous lot.
Madam Chair?
Senator Pappas?
You know, but the challenge is how do you get at the goal of decreasing density around lakes and moving toward conformity? I mean, that's what I think is the basic problem, is they've come up with this, maybe there are more solutions, but one solution is when you have contiguous lots that come under one ownership to try to move toward conformity. What other methods can be used? I don't know enough about the shoreline protection rules, but what other methods could be used to, you know, bring that lakeshore into conformity? It does seem to me this is an unfair method, you know, in certain circumstances. You know, maybe you could make it more unfair. If you were more fair by making it more difficult for someone else to buy nonconforming property.
Madam Chair.
Senator Vickerman.
Was it Mr. Carlson? I'm kind of curious what happened in the other body. Did he say they passed, or what did they?
The bill, I'm assuming, was laid over in the committee.
Well, Madam Chair, I'm going to go into the county commissioner and township part of me.
Okay.
And as I said earlier, I want to be sure what we're doing, because this can be, there's a lot of lakes. We're the land of 10,000 lakes. We could have lots all over, but I feel I'm sympathetic to you. I don't want to kill it, so if I would make the move to lay it on the table, then does it stay here kind of alive until we have time to?
Well, if you move to lay the bill on the table, I, we're going to adjourn sine die, so the bill eventually, so the bill wouldn't be alive in the committee. But I think the we've had a really full hearing on this, and it seems to me if you did make that motion that there certainly is a directive to the local units of government and the DNR to resolve these issues so that homeowners like Ms. Ness and Mr. Bakke and the gentleman from Minnetonka don't have to go through such headaches to, take care of their families and provide for their future. So it's kind of how I feel. But what would you like to do? Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, I think you're right. We've had a very good hearing on this, and I think every member of the committee sympathizes with these situations and recognizes there's a just absolute unfairness here when sometimes even without, in most of these cases at least, not knowing the consequences of buying that property nearby, trying to do the right thing. So there's definitely a problem here. I think even if we pass it out of here, though, I think the bill is dead for this session, if it's dead in the House and so on. I guess I would suggest that maybe we make it clear, as I think we have, that the committee is very interested in not just in trying to work between the DNR and the counties in developing, trying to find a fair way to do this. There is no perfect answer, but also that we look and see in these particular cases if there's a way to maybe as part of it, finding a better way to deal with variances in a way to minimize this, if we could do something to beef up the disclosure when property is sold. That doesn't help any of these three situations, but I have a feeling that if we're going to try and deal with those three situations or however many we're going to try and deal with, that might be better done next session when there's a chance the bill might actually pass.
And the bill would come in this committee first, too, again. Senator Pappas?
Just another quick comment, Madam Chair. If the committee was inclined to pass it, then another limitation would be to just allow it for maybe a limit, two lots, one contiguous lot, because you could get a situation where, some owners own, 10, 20 nonconforming lots. And so that's another example of, we might be trying to help these three people, but the law can have a lot broader application.
Anybody else have advice on what we should do, Senator Randevere?
I could make one quick comment, Madam Chair. We did have we had it restricted to three lots at one point, and we were told to go work with the DNR. I think if we could get some encouragement from the committee to do that. When we did sit down and talk with them, I don't know if you've ever negotiated with DNR before, but we hit a couple walls. This has been going on for about 5 years. So just keep that in mind. We had it down to three lots. It was in the A1 amendment. So,
Senator Vandeveer, I think there is I think commitment on the part of this committee to take on and support you in a very important issue, but maybe not in this bill right now. And I would like the department, Mr. Lacasmo, to know that we do take Senator Vandeveer's concerns about getting to a solution very, very seriously, and we want a solution, whether it's in rule or whether the department itself comes back with some statutory language that leads us to a solution. Mm-hmm. So Senator Vickerman moves that Senate file 2872 be laid on the table. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Vandeveer,
for
bringing the bill to us. There being no further business before the committee, we stand adjourned.
Yeah. Oh, God, I'd hate to be on the city council.